Hey, gorgeous lady. How you doing?
Hi, beautiful. I am not gorgeous right now. You are gorgeous right now. I can't handle it. She looks fabulous.
Thank you. Well, that's because when I saw you in the flesh a couple days ago, you were the gorgeous one and I was the dumpster fire personified.
She was not. We've definitely traded places this time, though. I was like, I'm rocking the baggy sweatshirt, no makeup, hair's a wreck, and you're looking absolutely stunning, of course.
Thank you. I try. I'm working later. That's, I have to do it for the people, you know.
I feel that. But yes, I got to see your apartment finally.
I know, after like almost 4 years of knowing each other.
Not that strange, honestly. Like in New York, you meet people at bars, you go out.
Yeah, for sure.
But your apartment was very cute and she has a million skulls. I can vouch for this.
I do. Yeah. They're cute though.
They're very cute. Your whole apartment is cute.
Thank you.
I felt honored, honestly. Because I also got to meet Dandy while I was there. And Dandy also has never seen your apartment.
That's right.
So
most people haven't because my life is really chaotic. So I want to spend very little time in my apartment. And when I do, it's like a drop and go thing. So that like accumulates and then it's just looks like a fucking bomb went off in the place. And not only that, like just very, a lot of the time it's like 2 a.m. that I'm available when most people are like sleeping or going home from.
Yes.
You know.
You're not inviting most people back to your apartment at 2 a.m. Be like, hey, you want to hang out, watch a movie?
No, I don't even want to watch a movie at 2 a.m.
No.
No. So yes. So that's usually why no one's seen my apartment. But I'm so glad that you have and that Dandy has and you guys met because the reason why she met is Amy and I were meeting to go over some cool stuff coming up for the pod. Stay tuned.
Super secret stuff that I'm excited mm-hmm. about, but we can't actually talk about
nope,
yet.
Not for a few more weeks, but it's exciting. It's good stuff. And I saw Dandy recently and she's like, it's still super fucked up that I haven't met Amy. And I was like, well, Amy's coming over my place. So if you want to crash this meeting, then you're totally down. And she did.
She did. And I was so excited. Dandy is lovely. She's so sweet.
Of course.
I really had a wonderful time with her and talking cats with her because she also has a cat. Mm-hmm. So I was living all my kitty dreams.
It was so good. It was so fun.
I know. I had a blast with you and I'm excited. It's one of those things like I want to say more things and talk about it, but I can't.
I know.
I signed an NDA.
Yeah, it's not that serious. No NDAs, but
no, that was a joke. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not doing like a fucking Marvel movie or something. That'd be pretty cool, but no. But we do have a lot of exciting things that we've like teased a little bit in the last few weeks that are coming very soon, and we can't tell you just yet, but we are so excited about all of it.
To be revealed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm.
So what else is going on, Gorge?
I mean, the highlight of my week was literally seeing you.
I mean, same.
I really haven't done anything too crazy.
Me neither.
No shows. Keeping up on Shogun, which is, again, insane. The end of this episode was very gory and violent, unexpectedly.
Oh.
But I'm here for it. I still recommend watching it.
Amazing. I only watched the penultimate episode of Feud, Capote versus the Swans, which was very good. All the episodes have been very good. So there's one more episode that I think dropped today as we're recording or yesterday, but we'll likely not be able to see it for a bit. But that's kind of it. Yeah, truly. Highlight of my week was just getting to see you and hang out with you in the flesh.
Same. I did also watch the new Hot Ones episode
with
Jamie Dornan from The Tourist, and he seems just lovely.
I love it.
Like, he was very funny. He quoted Anchorman in it. So, like, immediately, be still my heart.
Amazing.
Sold.
I love it. I don't think I've seen a new Hot Ones since Pedro Pascal.
His was really good, too.
Oh, yeah.
I went on a little Hot Ones binge, I want to say a couple weeks ago, and I watched a bunch of episodes that I hadn't seen yet that I needed to catch up on.
That's how it always is with Hot Ones. It's like how the Lace commercial was like, you just can't have one. You just can't watch one Hot Ones.
Yes. I feel like it's like feast or famine. Like, I won't watch it for months going on years. And then suddenly I'm like, oh, I have like 47 episodes to catch up on. Amazing.
10,000%.
But that was wonderful.
I should do a Hot One.
Oh, I'm not going to lie, that is secretly my dream. If this podcast ever takes off, I would love to go on Hot Ones.
I would love to go on Hot Ones with you just to see the vast juxtaposition between you like nailing it and me crying like the first fucking wing. Because Amy with hot sauce hard.
I do fuck with hard. Hot sauce.
I do not at all. At all. I don't fuck with hot sauce.
But you're Cuban. I feel like you grew up with some spicy food. No, not at all.
Cuban food's not spicy.
Oh.
Yeah. Central American and Southern American food is spicy. Like Peruvian spicy will like fuck up your life. But Cuban food is not spicy at all.
Interesting. I don't think I realized that because whenever my family makes Cuban food, they make it a little spicy. They've been lying to me this whole time.
Yeah, they've added. That's a that's an artistic license. Yeah, Cuban food is not spicy at all. It has spices and is flavorful, but it's not spicy.
That is a keen distinction. Okay.
Yeah. So I could just see me being like Jennifer Lawrence crying, like being like, what do you mean? And then Amy being like Lord, being like, oh, you know, this is
not too bad.
It's nice. I would love that because I would suffer immediately.
I still suffer. I would definitely like feel the burn, especially like everyone besides David Blaine, who he obviously is a wizard or something because he did not even react at all. But like everyone gets fucked up by Da Bomb. They literally have it in every season because it's so fucking hot.
Right.
It like doesn't have any flavor. It's just hot.
See, but I think one of the key differences between me and you, which I adore, is like you need to win. And I'm kind of like, I'm down to admit defeat immediately. I'm like, that's fine.
Oh, no, I would have to make it through.
Absolutely. And you'd be like, I'm not even going to flinch about this shit. You could be dying, but you'd be like, no, I'm good. I'm good. I got it.
You have more faith in me than I do. I'm going to say that for the record. I mean, I would definitely be like breathing heavily and probably drinking milk, at least water, even though I know it makes it worse. Technically, I feel like it doesn't.
I don't know. Yeah, I would enjoy that, again, just to see like how vastly different our reactions would be. Something for everyone.
Yes. When the people freak out, though, that's the best part. Like, that's the funniest part of the show. It's not as funny when you act unaffected by it.
That's true.
Yeah. No, I definitely get like the sweats from eating hot food and your like scalp gets tingly. Like, I've experienced all that.
That sounds terrible. Why would you do that? Why would you seek that out for your dining experience?
You know what? That's a very fair question. I mean, God, some things are just so good and you suffer through it. We used to make this mac and cheese that was just, it was the best mac and cheese. But we made a couple batches that were so fucking spicy that literally I felt my scalp tingling. But I was like, it's so fucking good. Like, I'm just going to breathe through it and keep going.
That's awful.
It's so good.
I mean, I love that journey for you, girl. But no, I'm not gonna do that.
That's fine. I honestly used to be that way. My parents love spicy food and I really didn't care for it at all. And it wasn't until I started dating Johnny and he made everything spicy that I came to enjoy spicy food.
For those of you who don't know just to what level Amy fucks with spicy food, when they traveled, one of the times Johnny and her moved, one of their suitcases was full of hot sauce.
Oh my God. I had kind of forgot about that. Yes.
Oh, I have not. No.
We had one of the space bags that you can vacuum seal, and we did one layer of hot sauce and then put a beach towel over it and did another layer of hot sauce and then vacuum sealed the bag. So there were like almost 100, I feel like.
And you're going to tell me you don't think you'd crush hot ones? Get the fuck out of here.
I mean, I would. I mean, you're right. I definitely would have to win and I would have to eat them all, but I would suffer. I couldn't do it unaffected. I would 100% be talking about how hot it was and how my mouth was on fire and I was dying and how dare he do this to me.
Yeah, but she'd be like cool about it. I wouldn't.
I would be like cute, dying, it's fine. So yeah, if anyone out there knows anyone on Hot Ones and wants to get us on the show, please and thank you. That is my dream.
I mean, facts, for sure. So we're just going to put that out into the universe and manifest it.
Yes. I mean, you're amazing at manifesting, so if anyone's going to get this fucking done, it's you.
I mean, I've dabbled. Things have happened. We'll see.
I love it. The only other thing that I experienced this week, which I'm not 100% sure really happened or if it was all in my head and I'm losing my mind. I may have experienced a glitch in the Matrix.
What?
Yeah. It sounds so silly. It's literally about pillowcases.
Okay.
Which I'm like laughing at myself. I'm literally like pausing because I'm like, do I even say this? It sounds so insane. I am very particular about my pillows and my pillowcases on my bed. Mm-hmm. I have 6 pillows total. I have like 2 special Tempur-Pedic ones. They each get their own special case. Then I have 4 of the same brand of pillows, 2 which go in a gray silk case and 2 which go in pink pillow shams. I recently did all the laundry on my bed, changed everything, put everything back the way it was. And I am so crazy about these pillows that I can literally, by feel, tell the difference between what are my pillows and what are Johnny's pillows.
Totally. I totally feel you.
So I'm like very particular about it. So I walk into the bedroom the other day and I'm like, huh, that's weird. There's no longer 2 pillows in the pink shams. There are the 2 silk pillows. There is my pillow in the pink sham. And then there is one that's in just like a generic gray pillowcase that I have. So I'm like, oh, that's weird. Maybe Johnny like moved the couch and took one of the pillows with him and brought the wrong one back. Go look in the living room. No, all the pillows on the couch are gray, as they should be. I'm like, okay. So I asked Johnny, I'm like, hey, did you spill something on one of the pillows and change the pillowcase? And he's like, what are you talking about? I didn't spill anything on the pillowcase and I didn't change any of the pillowcases. And I'm like, I'm not gonna be mad. Like, just tell me. There should be 2 pink pillowcases and there's not anymore. And he was like, I swear to you, babe, I didn't spill anything on any of the pillows. I didn't change any of the pillows. I'm like, okay, am I going insane? This has been days that I was sure there were 2 pink pillowcases on this bed. So I look through the laundry. There's no dirty pillowcase. What the fuck? I go to the stack of clean laundry and there are all 3 because I have 2 sets of the pink shams because I have multiple of the duvet cover. And 3 of them are clean and folded in the pile. I am sure, because there's no reason I would make the bed without the 2 pillow shams.
Right.
I made the bed multiple days in a row after I changed the sheets. And I stack the pillows the same way every time. Pink ones go on top. I for sure saw that 2 of them were in the pink pillowcases. But apparently that is not true. And I only put 1 on and all 3 are clean and folded in a stack of laundry. So I'm losing my mind. Or there's a glitch in the Matrix. I'm more comfortable with there being a glitch in the Matrix than me actually losing my mind.
You know, it's funny you say this because I did have a very similar thing happen to me last night while I was working. So I also tend bar in a venue like that does like concerts and stuff like that. And usually when you show up, your bar has already been set up for you and you have like your mixers and your juices and whatever. And a lot of times, like when people ask for like a gin and tonic or whatever, we don't have fresh fruit because it spoils. So we'll have lemon juice or lime juice. So I go to offer someone, you know, if they want lemon or lime juice with their gin and tonic, and they're like, yeah, like a lime would be great. And I look down and I only have 2 lemon juices. I was like, oh, I'm sorry about that. I actually just have lemon, you know, and it's a very like small area that you have. So I give the guy lemon juice, whatever, like fast forward 20, 30 minutes. I look down and there's a lemon and a lime juice and they're right next to each other. And the thing is, it's like, it's not like you can just kind of like confuse them. One's a green bottle and the other one's a yellow bottle.
Yeah.
And I looked down and there was 2 yellow bottles. And then 20 minutes later, there was a yellow and a green bottle.
And you didn't leave the bar at all during this time?
No.
This makes me feel so much better. Thank you.
Got you. I thought it was very odd, but there was too many people for me to like pause on it because I was like, oh, I have to like do my job. But there was absolutely 2 fucking lemon juices, which is why I had to like pull a lime juice from someone else. And then I gave it back to them. And then when I like a few minutes later, like 20 minutes later, it was no longer 2 lemon juices.
Weird. Girl, I know. I feel it. I thought I was going insane because I'm like very weird and OCD about my pillows.
I totally get it.
And apparently this is the one time I didn't take a million pictures of Boo in my bed because I literally went back through my camera roll to be like, I need to find proof that there were 2 fucking pink pillowcases on my bed because they're not anymore. And I fucking know I put it on there. But this is the one time and I had no photographic evidence.
How convenient. Cosmically.
The Matrix knows. That's all I'm saying.
There you go. That's pretty bizarre, though.
It's very weird. But yeah, it's one of those things, like, it's so subtle that I'm just like, okay, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I just forgot.
Except you know you didn't.
Except I know I didn't.
Yeah.
Because I'm very weird about my pillows and I want consistency.
Yeah.
On that slightly creepy note, I feel like that leads us perfectly into our paranormal story.
What a fucking segue. Absolutely. Yes. Just going to jump right into it. Sources: The Confessionals Podcast, Telescope.com, MentalFloss.com, Wikipedia.com, Phys.org, NASA.gov, RockyElmore.com, the book Deviance Management by Christopher D. Bader and Joseph O. Baker, and the Spooked Podcast, which we all know and love.
Spooked.
Love Spooked.
So excited.
From 1994 to 2014, Rocky Elmore worked as a U.S. Border Patrol agent. In the 90s, he was stationed along the border fence in the Otay Mountains, just east of San Diego. There had recently been a wildfire in the area that had burned off 25,000 acres of the Otay Mountains, nearly claiming the entire mountain range. As a result, the landscape resembled the moon, with black soot covering the ground and the giant boulders that populated the region. The fire had reduced these giant rocks to nothing more than delicate outer shells that would break and collapse whenever one of the agents attempted to scale one, making navigating the terrain quite precarious. In addition to the inherent dangers of navigating such an unstable landscape, there were predators to be aware of. Rocky said, quote, "When I first got to Otay Mountain, the place felt different from other places I had been, because it's quite easy as a Border Patrol agent to feel like your top dog. But when I went up to Otay Mountain, it set in that there were predators there that could kill a human being nearly instantly." End quote. The top dogs on Otay Mountain were undoubtedly mountain lions.
Ooh.
Girl.
Yeah, no, no.
No, you do not want to fuck with a mountain lion.
No, that is terrifying.
Normally, it would be extremely rare for a mountain lion to attack a human, but seeing as how there wasn't much in terms of food supply for the cats other than rabbits and the occasional deer, mountain lions quickly lost their fear of man, and people immediately entered the food chain. And as we learned from Amy's amazing man-eating tiger story from a few weeks ago, it's pretty easy for an apex predator to hunt humans. All the mountain lions would have to do was pick out a group, follow it, wait for someone to trail behind, and that was it. Rocky said, quote, "We found quite a few bodies, and we found them on a fairly regular basis. Now, as far as I know, none of these kills went onto the official California record. Things that happen down on the border just have a tendency to just stay on the border," end quote, which is fucking horrifying.
Yes.
Can you imagine just getting fucking eaten by a mountain lion and no one knows? Because they don't even make a report or record of it?
No, that's horrifying. And then, like, in my head, I'm horrifying. Like, are there even enough remains to really, like, even identify the bodies or anything? Like, fuck.
And especially since most of the people who are getting attacked are, you know, immigrants who are crossing the border illegally. So
yeah.
I'm going to guess the U.S. doesn't give a fuck.
No. I also can't imagine that being just, like, a regular part of your job where you're like, oh, another mountain lion kill. Cool.
Fucking right.
I'll add it to the tally.
Oh, a personal tally, because no one else is going to give a fuck.
Yeah.
Rocky recounted an incident when he was working a midnight shift at Otay Lakes with a trainee when a sensor had gone off. So the two men went over to investigate. Rocky had always carried a revolver with him, but the Border Patrol had recently changed its policy the previous evening and decided that all agents would now carry a semi-automatic handgun. The new handgun came with a holster that was very close to the body, which was quite different from the one he was used to. A few minutes into their investigation, the two agents heard a noise on the hillside. The trainee got excited, thinking that he was going to catch people crossing the border. But Rocky soon realized that the noise was much too quiet to be a person, so it had to have been made by an animal, likely a deer. A few seconds later, Rocky heard what he described as, quote, the most terrifying noise I ever heard in my life. It was a mountain lion screaming. I've always heard it described as the scream of a woman being murdered.
Oof.
Girl. But I have never heard a human scream that could come anywhere near what a mountain lion scream is like. It's something that you just have to hear for yourself to truly understand. End quote. So when the men heard the scream, they turned around and saw a full-grown mountain lion charging directly at them. Rocky reached for his gun, but he couldn't get the new semi-automatic out of its new holster. It was stuck. Try as he might, he couldn't get the gun. And as the cat barreled down on the men, Rocky called out for his trainee to shoot the wild animal. But either his gun was also stuck, or he was just petrified in fear and didn't shoot the apex predator. At the last second, the mountain lion darted off to the side, and they immediately lost sight of him. That's when they heard it attack its intended target, a deer. Can you imagine?
I mean, I would need new pants.
Yes.
Fucking immediately.
Life flashed before your eyes. What the fuck?
Also, I'm turning in my resignation. Thanks.
Yeah.
I don't want to be eaten by a mountain lion as like a hazard of the job. Thank you.
Yes, exactly. Rocky said, quote, and then the screaming started all over again. And it was worse than the first scream. It was a combination of the animal he had hit and then the cat just tearing it to pieces. But as scary as mountain lions were, they weren't the only thing out there to be afraid of. End quote.
Oh my God. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. I literally gave myself chills saying that.
I've had chills throughout the mountain lion attack. There is just something so visceral that your body is like, no. Rejects this idea completely.
Girl, I fucking know. Because it's literally primal.
Yes. And technically, we are still supposed to be a part of that world, but we've somehow removed ourselves from it. So that doesn't seem like a real thing that could happen to us, but it fucking could.
No problem.
Yep.
Yeah. Ugh. When Rocky Elmore joined the United States Border Patrol, he knew the job came with inherent risks and dangers. But he could have never predicted that his new career would lead him to surreal encounters with the paranormal. In early March of 1995, Rocky had been on the field training for about 4 months. It was a bright moonlit night, and he was working a midnight shift with a training officer and two other trainees. They were headed out to the Otay Lakes when the fog rolled in. Because even though San Diego is an arid area, the Otay Mountains would often get a lot of marine fog that came up and hung on the range at various times of the year. While navigating the terrain in the fog, the men got turned around and got lost. Now, they weren't like, we're super fucked kind of lost. They knew approximately where they were, but they couldn't find the trail or any distinguishing landmarks. After walking for several minutes, trying to locate the trail, the men decided to hike alongside a little tributary that seasonally fed into the south end of Otay Lake. As they were walking to the creek, they suddenly heard this very, very large splash in the middle of the water. Rocky said, quote, it sounded as if some exceptionally large object had fallen from the sky and crashed into the water. And it just made one splash. There was no follow-up thrashing of water or anything like that. End quote. Working night operations, it was paramount that everyone remained quiet. So the trainees looked at their training officer, who nodded his head toward the creek, and the four men headed that way without speaking a word. But before they could even see the creek, the training officer drew his weapon, which struck Rocky as odd since, one, there were four of them, so safety in numbers and all, and two, no one had drawn their firearm during Rocky's 4 months of training. So it kind of freaked him out. But the closer they got to the waterway, the more Rocky felt a sense of doom and foreboding come over him. The hair on the back of his head stood straight up, and he said, quote, it was as if something was projecting its emotion onto me. It was starting to mess with my mindset and my feelings. like they were being projected onto me by whatever we were about to see in the water. And I knew we were about to see something horrible. And I started trying to mentally prepare myself for that. End quote. Once they reached the water's edge, the men immediately noticed 4 or 5 coyotes anxiously walking up and down the side of the creek, with their attention squarely on the middle of the water. The coyotes paid no mind to the 4 Border Patrol agents, which in and of itself was weird. Whenever people or other animals intruded in a coyote's area, they would go crazy, howling and yapping. But these coyotes were silent, almost as if they were too afraid to yap. Equally unusual was that the 4 men, all of whom had their guns drawn at this point, walked up between the coyotes, something they would never normally do, because of the very real possibility of getting bit and having to get rabies shots.
What the fuck is happening right now? I've clearly never heard this spooked episode. I am on the edge of my seat.
I don't think you're ready for what's happening.
No.
Because I remember the spooked episode, which is why I chose to do it. And then he's recounted it on other podcasts with more detail. And then I did other side googling, and no one is prepared for where the fuck this story's going. Just saying.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Girl. But Rocky said he was standing no more than 18 inches away from one of the coyotes.
Bro, what?
Girl, they're like right up like bosom buddies and shit. But everyone was so focused and worried on what was in the water that man and coyote alike just ignored each other. What the fuck?
The coyotes were like, are you seeing this?
Basically.
You guys are seeing this, right?
Basically. They all heard something very quietly moving through the water as if a person was shuffling their feet very softly and making their way back east. They turned on their flashlights and followed the sound upstream, but they couldn't see anything as the fog had not only obstructed their view, but blinded the men, shining their lights back into their own eyes. And here's the thing. All the coyotes were dry, meaning that none of them had been responsible for the large splash. So the Border Patrol agents decided to look for tracks, hoping to identify the unknown being in the water. But the only footprints they found were those of the coyotes and their own. Certainly nothing large enough to make the level of splash of whatever was in the creek had made. The coyotes, with their ears lowered and their tails tucked between their legs, eventually got out of there, looking back over their shoulders at whatever was in the water as they were leaving.
No, that gave me chills.
The animals fucking know.
They know. Something is fucking up. You need to follow them. Get the fuck out of there.
So the agents tried to follow the wild animals back east, but abandoned that once the brush got thick and unsurpassable. After much searching and coming up empty-handed, the men also gave up. They abandoned their mission, headed back west, and went back to business as usual, knowing that whatever was in that water would eventually walk out in front of the night vision scope that their supervisor had set up on the mountain. All the scopes the Border Patrol had at the time were thermal scopes, meaning that they could pick up heat signatures. While you couldn't tell someone's facial features from a thermal scope, you could easily tell what things are, with Rocky saying that you could see a rabbit in total darkness 2 miles away wiggle its ears.
Fuck, that's actually really impressive.
I know. I was not aware that that was the level.
Yeah.
But their heat signatures didn't always look like what the thing was. For instance, a person walking 1 or 2 miles away didn't really look like a human being. They looked more like an upright coffin. So you had to train to be able to determine what it was that was giving off heat. An agent named Jeb was working the thermoscope that night, and by Rocky's estimation, Jeb was the best scope operator in the entire Border Patrol. If anyone would be able to make out whatever was in the water, it would be Jeb. And whatever was in the water was headed in Jeb's direction and would be there in about 20 or 30 minutes. Jeb would identify it, and the mystery would be solved. Despite the fact that none of the men in Rocky's group said anything to one another about what they had experienced, he knew that there was something off and otherworldly about it. Shortly thereafter, Jeb had called in 2 other agents to work the route coming down off the mountain. But about 20 minutes later, Rocky and the other trainees overheard snippets of a radio transmission from Jeb, who had suddenly called the 2 men off their patrol. The agents were confused as they didn't understand why they were being called off, and therefore somewhat hesitant to leave as they wanted to finish the assignment they'd started. But Jeb was adamant, reiterating with more urgency that the men were being called off, telling them that there was a very large predator following them, and immediately ordered the two agents to get in their vehicles and leave the area. Despite the fact that the two men couldn't see anything and couldn't see this predator that was stalking them, they did what they were told because that's what you do when you're in the Border Patrol. You don't question orders. So that was the talk of the station over the next few days, with people throwing around ideas as to what they thought the large predator could be, with most assuming that it was likely a mountain lion.
Is this literally predator, though, where it can camouflage itself? What is happening?
Girl, we're getting into it.
I know. You're going to tell me. You're going to spill all the tea. I know. I just get impatient. I want to know.
I know, because the story's fucking crazy. And, like, I didn't understand the level. So everyone thinks it's a mountain lion, but when one of Rocky's fellow trainees privately asked him what he thought was in the water that night, Rocky said, quote, "I don't know, but I was getting very bad vibrations off of it," end quote, to which his colleague agreed. And the men knew that they had experienced something out of the ordinary. Rocky knew that whatever was in the water that night wasn't a mountain lion because one, just like regular cats, which Amy found out very recently, mountain lions hate the water. So it would be, even when they're really hot, they won't go in the water to cool off. So it would be very strange that a mountain lion would just be walking up the river, fucking chilling out. And two, even stranger, that none of the agents would be able to see it, let alone a very big mountain lion. So Rocky didn't buy the mountain lion story, but he wasn't going to question his supervisor about it. Rocky was the new guy, and questioning a higher up about something like this was a strict no-no. So Rocky kept his thoughts about the unsettling incident to himself. A few months later, Jeb got a new job back east. But before he left, he started telling a few stories to some of the agents that he knew well, which Rocky says is very common practice, that agents wait till they leave to start spilling the tea about their experiences, which I totally get.
I get it, and I love it. Same. I'm here for it.
Same.
I would find everybody who's ready to leave and just, like, immediately become their best friend.
You're like, hey.
I want to fucking know. Yeah.
Yeah, because in one of the podcasts, Jeb says, like, crazy shit happened during his time all the time, but that you would never talk about it because you didn't want it getting back that someone thought you're crazy and you'd get, like, a psych eval and, like, maybe lose your job. So you just didn't say anything. You basically waited, like, as, like, the parting shot when you left to be like, by the fucking way.
In case you guys don't know,
BT-dubs.
This is going down.
We're fucked. This is crazy.
There's some paranormal shit happening out here, so watch your back.
Dude. Jeb told the agents that night, the thing he had seen on the scope was not a mountain lion, but some sort of bipedal creature that had come up out of the Otay River and had started stalking the two agents that were working the area. He said the creature produced the largest heat signature he had ever seen and towered over the men.
Holy fuck, dude.
That whatever it was between 10 and 12 feet tall.
No!
Girl, obviously much bigger than any bear. And not only that, there were no bears in the area. Rocky said that in the entire time he worked the Otay Mountains, not only was there never a bear incident, but that he had never even seen a bear there. Nevertheless, these two agents were being stalked by a bipedal creature that was larger than a bear, and they were completely unaware of it. Rocky remembered that it was a bright moonlit night on the night in question, that you could see quite well even without your flashlights. And just like their experience with whatever was in the creek, the two agents who were being stalked saw nothing. This huge creature was towering over the men, right on top of them, but somehow invisible to the naked eye, only visible on the scope via its heat signature.
Predator. That's my guess. Probably not right, but I stand by it.
I don't think it's necessarily wrong. We're going to get into it.
Oh my God, I love you.
Over the next several years, Rocky heard more stories from both agents and people illegally crossing the border. In every experience, an unknown, unseen creature would stalk and chase its prey. And while the beast could have easily caught them, it curiously never did. Almost as if the whole goal was just to scare the unsuspecting people for fun.
Oh, that's fucked up.
Right?
It's like toying with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's some like psychological warfare bullshit.
For sure. And whenever agents were called in to investigate the incident, no signs of the creature would be found. No footprints, no scat, no nothing, leaving no clues as to what it was they were dealing with. Then, one night, Rocky was working a shift on the mountain when he ran into a group of Bureau of Land Management personnel. They weren't law enforcement, but more environmentalists. And he came across them in one of the more remote and treacherous areas of the mountain. Curious as to what had brought the group up that way, Rocky pulled over and asked them what they were doing. And the environmentalist said that they were working for Bear Scat, which Rocky found odd because, again, there were no bears in the area. And again, not only had Rocky never seen one, no one had ever even reported a sighting of one. So the men chatted some, and Rocky decided to go for it and said, quote, "What do you think about some kind of Sasquatch creature being up here?" End quote. Which he ended with a chuckle.
Yeah, you're like, haha, JK, but also for real?
But also.
Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, exactly, because he doesn't want these people to think he's insane. But none of the Bureau of Land Management personnel laughed. In fact, one of them started talking, saying that they believed that there were three of them in the area.
Shut the fuck up!
Two adults.
Oh, it's a little Squatch family.
And a juvenile, yes. Aww. And that they were a family unit.
That's cute.
And all the while, Rocky waited for the men to burst out laughing, saying that they were just pulling his leg. But they never did. They were deadly serious. And that's when Rocky started looking into the Bigfoot phenomena. And Rocky, like myself, had always heard of Bigfoot as being some sort of missing link, lost primate. Half monkey, half man. But apparently, there's another camp in the Sasquatch community that believes that Bigfoot is not merely an animal, but some type of spiritual, extraterrestrial, interdimensional being that has the ability to slip in and out of dimensions using portals. And when I heard the Spooked episode, I was like, oh, so this is like a skinwalker. This is probably what this is. And then there was like, yeah. Bigfoot. I was like, Bigfoot? Like, what the fuck? Like, okay, relax, guy, because we've officially jumped the Bigfoot shark. And yes, space portals are a common trope in science fiction, where explorers use interdimensional shortcuts to travel to unknown distances through space and time. But they're not real, except apparently they are. So space portals form via the process of magnetic reconnection, mingling lines of magnetic force from the sun and earth crisscross and join to create portals or openings where solar wind can enter.
What?
Girl.
This is my jam. How have I not heard this?
I don't know why the fuck no one has heard of this, but I've been on the NASA government website and all of this other NASA shit trying to understand this, but portals are fucking real. What the fuck? So it creates portals or openings where solar wind can enter the Earth's magnetic field. X points are where the crisscross takes place, and the sudden joining of magnetic fields can propel jets of charged particles from the X point, creating an, quote, electron diffusion region, end quote. In the late 90s, NASA's polar spacecraft spent several years in Earth's magnetosphere, and it encountered many X points during its mission.
Excuse me, what's it?
Girl. NASA-funded researcher and plasma physicist Jack Scudder of the University of Iowa said, quote, "They're places where the magnetic field of Earth connects to the magnetic field of the sun, creating an uninterrupted path leading from our own planet to the sun's atmosphere 93 million miles away, end quote. The issue is finding these X points, as the magnetic portals are invisible, unstable, and elusive. They open and close dozens of times a day without warning, and quote, there are no signposts to guide us in, end quote. But Scudder believes that he has figured out a way to find them. Using the data collected from the polar spacecraft, Scudder said, quote, we have found five simple combinations of magnetic field and energetic particle measurements that tell us when we've come across an X point or an electron diffusion region. A single spacecraft, properly instrumented, can make these measurements, end quote. In 2015, NASA launched the Magnetospheric Multiscale Mission, or MMS, which incidentally are my initials.
It's fate.
I love it. A robot space mission that used four identical spacecrafts bristling with energetic particle detectors and magnetic sensors spread out in Earth's magnetosphere and surrounded the portals to observe how they work. In 2016, the MMS mission was the first to directly detect magnetic reconnection. Since then, the MMS has detected magnetic reconnection occurring in unexpected places. In 2018, MMS made the first ever detection of magnetic reconnection in the magnetosheath, a region of space previously thought to be too chaotic and unstable to sustain reconnection. In August of 2019, astronomers reported that MMS made the first high-resolution measurements of an interplanetary shockwave from the sun. So, space portals are fucking real. So, what if Bigfoot is not only real, but is actually an alien creature not of this world who just drops in? Which, one, would explain the big splash that literally just a portal opened and he fell through.
Yes.
Two, could explain why this enormous creature of clearly flesh and blood who gave off a huge heat signature could stalk these two agents but still be able to cloak itself. Three, could explain why Sasquatch footprints have been known to vanish on their own without any rhyme or reason. Four, could explain the creature's elusive nature and why, for instance, no one ever finds Bigfoot bones. Because they literally live in another dimension and just pop in from time to time. Like, I think you may have mentioned it in your Kushka episode, your story, that, you know, there's an Alaska triangle and they think that there's a portal in Alaska, which is where all these like planes go missing. But there's also Bigfoot sightings. So what if these two things are connected?
Also, I can't remember what's story it is. It might be the one with the little boy whose like uncle like attacks the alien who's following him. I think it's that one. One of the stories, at least, that I did on extraterrestrials had one that looked like Bigfoot, which I thought was very weird.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like very specifically. And they said like that's possibly where like the idea for Chewbacca came from.
Oh.
I have heard this theory before that Bigfoot is some sort of interdimensional being. I did not know all of this about the portals, though. And
same.
You just opened up a rabbit hole. So I'm going to have to investigate this later. Thank you, Monique.
Same, because I had heard the thing about, like, Bigfoot's an alien. I was like, people just need to fucking relax with all of this.
You're, like, mixing all of your tropes here.
For
like,
sure. And, you know, the Venn diagram is enough. But, no, apparently NASA's saying that this is real, that they have been able to basically make connections with places that are unreachable or that we thought would be unreachable, and they're able to make these connections through these portals. Either way, this experience made Rocky a believer. After he retired, Rocky wrote the book Out on Foot, Nightly Patrols and Ghostly Tales of a U.S. Border Patrol Agent, detailing the many paranormal incidents he and his fellow agents experienced during his 34-year career as a U.S. Border Patrol agent. And that is the story of Rocky Elmore's first paranormal experience as a Border Patrol agent, where he may have encountered a Sasquatch from another dimension because space portals are real.
I love you, Monique.
I love you.
That story was amazing. I'm like just in shock, and I'm so weirdly disappointed in myself that I didn't know portals were real before this.
I don't know why none of us knew that and why they haven't made it a bigger thing.
Yeah, it's the Bigfoot conspiracy. They don't want you to know.
Probably.
That is deeply fascinating, though. That makes me wonder if, because I know like ley lines were always dismissed as just like a thing that we made up and weren't real. And I wonder if there's any overlap between like ley lines and where these portals supposedly appear, and that maybe the ley line thing isn't bullshit after
all. Sure. And especially since apparently they say that the portals open and close every day, multiple times a day. So it could be like, this is a thing that happened. Then you go there and there's like, it's closed. So you're like, well, fuck. And then you just look like an asshole. Or it could also be why maybe like if Bigfoot is not from here, why maybe they get stuck here?
Yeah. This is just like opened up a can of worms. Like now I'm thinking about your fairy story. Like, girl. Literally, I mean, aliens, obviously.
Obviously.
But like,
girl, this is what I'm saying. This was supposed to be an easy story for me this week. Instead, I was trying to figure out fucking NASA physics and shit. I'm like, I have a fucking drama degree. I don't know any of this. And then like watch, and then being like, what does this mean? Watching like infograph, like YouTube videos set out by NASA, by the fucking way, on their official like YouTube page, so that people like me who are not nuclear scientists or whatever, space scientists, can understand what the fuck this means, which ultimately just means portals are fucking real. They found them. It's just a thing that they open and close and move all of the time.
I am so, so deeply fascinated by this. Also, it's like freaking me out because now I'm thinking of like all the missing people who just like were never found.
10,000%.
Could not be explained. And it's like, did they just fucking walk into a portal and then got stuck somewhere else, or fucking wound up in space and just like died immediately or something? Like, fuck, dude.
This info like changes the fucking game. And I don't know why everyone doesn't know about it and everyone's not talking about it all of the fucking time.
This has some like dark consequences to it, this information.
For sure.
Okay. I didn't plan for you to wreck my brain today, Monique. Like, I love you, but kind of fuck off. Like, what?
Oh, same, literally to myself. I was researching the story and I was like, just going down the rabbit hole. And I was like, you can also just like not include this. Don't include this, because what are you doing?
The people need to know about the fucking portals.
How do we not know? It's out there. It's on their website. It's on, like, this isn't just like strictly on Reddit posts. Like, NASA is like, yeah, these are the things. There's Wikipedia pages about it. Like, it's like, these are the missions. This is what we've done. And I'm like, I'm sorry. What were we doing? Were we just all collectively watching like Survivor, the fucking Kardashians, and we just fucking missed this? What the fuck?
I guess so. NASA's like, hi, I'm sorry, where have you been? It's on my blog. Did you not read it? Okay, well then that's on you.
It was on my live journal, so that's your bad. Off.
I'm like speechless. My brow is furrowed. I'm shaking my head. My arms are crossed. I'm like so deeply fascinated and like kind of weirdly upset about this information.
It's upsetting.
But like my mind is blown.
How can it not be?
You opened this rabbit hole for me, too. I'm going to have to look this all of this up later.
I opened the portal. Ayo.
Hey. Obviously, you gave me the breakdown and wonderful information, but I need to see this.
Yes. And as a woman of science, Amy Traden, you will understand it a lot more than me, because it was like, oh, yeah, there's a thing. And I was like, wait, what?
That is very generous. I appreciate that. But yeah, I'm so intrigued.
What the fuck?
I'm kind of excited. Not to the point that I want to accidentally walk into a portal one day.
No,
but
definitely
like,
not.
No. Not unless it's going to, you know, transport me back to like a really hot Scotsman a la Outlander. If that's going to happen, I'm okay with that.
Just, it would explain so many things.
It really would. And the fact that like, we've talked about how like paranormal things are like very drawn to water.
Mm-hmm.
And like the fact that this happened over.
Yes.
Water.
Yep.
Makes me think like, all right, there's just a bunch of like portals over ponds and shit.
Yeah. Like I already knew like via science that like wormholes and all that are real.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that they were like here as well. Like I thought they were like in space.
Like real far away.
Mm-hmm.
Light years away.
Mm-hmm. No.
No, I didn't know this.
What the fuck?
All right. Well, I'm going to tell that to everyone I talked to this week.
Yep. I'm hanging out with Donna for like a Easter brunch thing. Sorry, everyone at Easter is going to hear about this.
They need to know. The people need to know.
Apologies in advance. How the fuck does not everyone know this?
Again, and when you're really 2015, I'm like, are you fucking serious? It's almost been a fucking decade and I'm just finding this out now.
And they had inklings of it in the fucking 90s.
We're in a simulation and everything's getting fucking weird. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, you know what? I hate that, but I'm not necessarily negating it. I just hate it.
I feel like you're more likely to believe it now that you found out portals are real. You're like, maybe, though.
Fucking portals are real.
I will never get over this.
No. How could you?
Thank you. I can die happy now, though, I think. Fuck. That is one of my favorite stories you have ever done, hands down.
Thank you.
I'm blown away. I'm not going to forget about this for like a long fucking time.
Thank you. Yeah, it fucks you up. Like, I'm not okay really knowing this information.
No. I have not uncrossed my arms since we started talking. I feel like I'm like protecting my vital organs from the portals or something. Like, I'm not okay.
Yeah.
I promise. Yes.
Bigfoot might be a predator who went through a portal.
Oh my God. And then just like all of our sci-fi movies just become documentaries. Great. Cool. Amazing. That's not terrifying.
That's amazing. Yeah, but I'm never going to leave my apartment again because that's horrifying.
Girl, they could appear anywhere. You could have a portal in your apartment. You don't know.
I know. Just try to get like a midnight pee, you know, in the middle of the night and just like, boom, you're somewhere else. What the fuck?
Now, if they can make a portal in my bladder so I don't have to get up to pee.
Girl.
Sign me up for that.
When I'm gonna check dinner.
Yeah, I'm on board.
Girl.
All right. I don't know how I'm going to come back from that, but I feel like we have to segue into our true crime story of the week.
We have to. If not, it wouldn't be our show.
Correct.
All right, baby. You got some fucked up crime for me? Are we doing an Amy Traded story? Or are we doing like a nice story?
We're doing a normal story.
Normal story.
You know, there's murder involved, but it's not the most horrific. It's no serial killer from last week like you.
I mean, what the fuck?
Yeah. So, you know, I love a theme. So I tried to find a good St. Patrick's Day.
I fucking love you. The holidays catch me off guard literally every time. As if they're not on the exact same fucking day every year.
I get it. You're dealing with a lot of things. Like, time goes very quickly. Like, sometimes I forget. I get it.
You know, Seal had it right. Time slips into the future. I'm so excited. Oh my God, I can't wait.
I'm excited. So this is not a crime that takes place on St. Patrick's Day. But during my Googling, this came up. And I was very intrigued.
I love it.
And I thought you would enjoy it. So here we go. Sources: The Most Notorious Podcast, episode 219, which was an interview with Jillian O'Brien, the author of Blood Runs Green, The Murder That Transfixed Gilded Age Chicago.
I'm already obsessed. What a fucking title.
I know.
Color me intrigued.
Right? It was one of those, like, I really wish I had had time to read the book. And then I looked at my schedule for the week and I was like, I just have to like listen to the podcast, read some articles. Yep. I don't have book time this week. Mm-hmm. Her website, which is JillianMOBrien.wordpress.com, MurderByGaslight.com, HistoryIreland.com, IrishTimes.com, IrishCentral.com, Chicagoology.com, and good old Wikipedia.
Also love Murder by Gaslight. Great website. Great stories.
I think that was the first time I ever came across it, and I really enjoyed it as well. Like, it was very thorough. That was honestly, like, pretty much my primary source.
I'm pretty sure I used them for the story about the woman who was just trying to get wifed up, and then in, like, 1800s New York, and it, like, wasn't working out for her because the guy, like, who's, like, a dentist, like, just kept fucking everyone. So then he got murdered, and they're like, but she's a woman. How could she possibly murder anyone with those weak arms? Do you even lift, bro? Except she totally did. I'm pretty sure I got a lot of information on that from Murder by Gaslight.
Was that the other one that was like a crime of the century?
Yes. And then they're buried like 800 feet away from each other. And he's like, bitch, this bitch won't fucking leave me alone. Fuck. I think it's like 100 feet. It's like nothing. It's
Hi, can I get a new grave? Thanks. I don't want to be right next to my murderer.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, great website for a lot of cool old-timey murders. Check them out.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. Very thorough. So, Patrick Henry Cronin was born in County Cork, Ireland on August 7th, 1846, but his family moved to New York City not long after. They moved again to Baltimore and later to Ontario, where at the age of 10, he was enrolled in the Academy of St. Catharines. After graduating with honors in 1863, he spent the next few years working in Pennsylvania as a schoolteacher before deciding to move to St. Louis, Missouri in 1867 when he was 23 years old. He worked as a porter for a wholesale house for a time, then as a ticket agent for the St. Louis and Southeastern Railroad. But Cronin was a very charismatic and ambitious young man and gained a reputation not only for that, but for his beautiful singing voice. Mm. He sang at Irish events, at his local Catholic church, and even in the choir of the Second Baptist Church, despite being a devout Catholic. Eventually, his singing and winsome personality, of course, drew the attention of several St. Louis businessmen, and the Bagnall Timber Company sponsored him to study at Missouri Medical College. After graduating there in the late 1870s, he continued his education at St. Louis University, where he earned his master's degree and a doctor of philosophy, and became known officially as Dr. Cronin. Dr. Cronin was involved with the revival of the St. Louis College of Physicians and Surgeons, and by the early 1880s was serving as its professor of eye and ear diseases. He became very well known in St. Louis society and was even chosen to attend the 1878 Paris Exposition, a World's Fair exhibition of fine arts and new machinery, as one of Missouri's state commissioners. He eventually set up a private practice in St. Louis and around this time began joining a number of Irish fraternal groups and secret societies. And let me tell you, dude loved his secret societies.
Who the fuck doesn't?
Right? He was a member of the Royal Arcanum and Chosen Friends, and in late 1876 joined the St. Louis chapter of Clan na Gael. He also joined the Foresters and the Royal League when he moved to Chicago in 1882.
So he's like, fuck the Freemasons. They're too high profile.
But I want to join like six other secret societies / fraternal organizations.
I fucking love it.
I'm into it. When did he find the time?
Girl, I mean, who the fuck are you telling? I recently found out that my uncle, my great uncle was a Freemason. And I found out when he was 90 fucking four. Talk about keeping that shit low key.
What?
Yeah, man.
That's great. I weirdly feel like my dad also told me that like my great-great-grandfather was a Freemason and like sent me a picture of him in like his fucking crazy Freemason's outfit and everything. And I honestly was like, did you just Google this picture? Like this, are you fucking with me?
Yeah, I found out more because there was like a flag at his funeral. And I was like, wait, what? And I was like, oh yeah, I used a Freemason. I'm like, what the fuck?
Way to bury the lead, guys.
10,000%.
They're everywhere. They live among us. We don't, you never know.
I mean, realistically, I know nothing about the Freemasons other than they're like super secretive and like kind of cool.
Yeah, same.
That's all I know.
I mean, that's a jam. It's a secret, Monique. You're not supposed to know.
Exactly. Oh, man.
So back to Clan na Gael. Clan na Gael was an oath-bound secret society that had emerged after the dissolution of another secret society called the Fenian Brotherhood, which was discredited in the U.S. after they attempted to invade Canada in 1866. Bold, guys.
What did Canada do to you? Leave them alone.
So their plan was to hold Canada hostage so that they could blackmail the United Kingdom to give Ireland its independence.
All of Canada?
No, like the British-controlled territories, whatever.
That's still half of it. That's a lot.
Again, it's a bold move. But obviously,
It didn't work out. A for effort, bro.
Yeah. Like the Fenian Brotherhood, Clan na Gael had the same ultimate goal to free Ireland from the rule of the British Empire and establish an independent Irish Republic. Although it was known in public as Clan na Gael, the group was referred to as the United Brotherhood by its estimated 10,000 members.
Damn.
Modeled after secret societies like the Freemasons, Clan na Gael had secret initiation rites, oaths, rituals, codes, and symbols. The organization was made up of various chapters in every major city known as camps, and the Chicago camp, Camp 20, was their headquarters. When Dr. Cronin moved to Chicago in 1882, he continued his involvement with Clan na Gael and sought to rise through the ranks of the Chicago camp. However, the year before, Clan na Gael had held a convention in Chicago where they'd established a 5-man executive board to govern the organization. And shortly after, 3 of the board members realized that they could control everything by forming an alliance and acting together.
Mm.
So Alexander Sullivan of Chicago, Michael Boland of Louisville, Kentucky, and Dennis Freely of Rochester, New York, formed a triumvirate that became known informally as the Triangle. And by 1884, were controlling Clan na Gael in secret under the leadership of Alexander Sullivan. Although Clan na Gael had previously just been focusing on fundraising, Sullivan wanted to take a more paramilitary role in their fight for Irish independence and engage in guerrilla warfare on British soil.
Oh!
I know. Taking it to the extreme here.
Yeah.
He had lost patience with Clan na Gael's sister organization in Ireland, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and decided to take matters into his own hands. He launched a campaign that became known as the Dynamite War, where young Irish Americans sailed to the UK and planted bombs in public spaces, including the Tower of London, Houses of Parliament, and London Bridge.
Holy shit!
Yes. However, these terrorist attacks, which included the 1885 bombing of the London Tower and House of Commons, were largely unsuccessful, and most of the bombs failed to detonate. The ones that were successful usually ended up killing only the men who carried them.
Bro.
I know. Womp womp.
That's not, I mean, obviously I don't want like a mass
bombing murder, but like.
Yeah, of course, but bro.
Yeah.
Quit while you're ahead. Don't quit your day job.
Yeah. After the first failed attempts, like, look at your life, look at your choices. Like, maybe stop doing this.
Yeah.
And even if they survived, they were almost always found and arrested by the British police. Dr. Cronin opposed the disastrous campaign for obvious reasons. And after the failure of the Dynamite War, joined the anti-triangle faction of Clan na Gael, eventually becoming their spokesman. The rivalry between Alexander Sullivan and Cronin simmered within the organization's ranks for years. There was some added tension because Sullivan had not been born in Ireland while Cronin had. So it was argued by many anti-Sullivan supporters that Sullivan was less committed to the cause than Cronin.
He's not even fucking Irish, bro.
Exactly.
His mom popped him out here. That's bullshit.
Yes. Which, like, no offense, although Cronin was born in Ireland, he moved to New York when he was a baby. Like, he literally doesn't remember it at all.
You also don't get to control where your mom pops you out, man.
Yeah.
Relax.
Yeah.
Like, fucking relax. Stop.
Cronin accused Sullivan of embezzlement and demanded that he account for the missing funds. In retaliation, Sullivan accused Cronin of treason, claiming he was a British spy, and ordered an internal trial with a panel of 5 men to try Cronin, including Dan Coughlin, a senior Clan na Gael member and a detective in the Chicago Police Department, and Henry LeCaron, who was a Sullivan supporter and who will come into play a little later.
Also, can I just add, I'm obsessed with every single name that you've said in this situation. I have a penchant for dating men from the Emerald Isle. So I'm just like how there's that trope of like, oh, tall, dark, and handsome. No. If you have an apostrophe in your last name and you get like red and freckly in the sun, I'm on that shit. I fucking love that shit. I love it so fucking hard. It's like sploosh central.
That is adorable. I mean, those accents alone, like how can you resist, girl, honestly?
Also, you've met my boyfriend. Like,
yes.
Check. Like, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've seen the evidence, Monique.
Exactly.
I got a solid case, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Although Cronin was found guilty of treason and expelled from the order during the internal trial, he gained a large following of anti-Sullivan supporters by that time. And thousands of Clan na Gael members quit the organization in solidarity and began forming their own camps. But the leaders of both factions quickly realized the goal of Irish independence could not be met unless they all worked together. So they urged their members to bury the hatchet. Mm-hmm. Dr. Cronin agreed on the condition that the actions of the Triangle be fully investigated, and in 1888, publicly accused them of embezzling $100,000 of Klan funds for personal gain, which, adjusted for inflation, is about $3.3 million. So,
damn.
Yeah. When I read $100,000 at first, I was like, oh, it doesn't seem so bad. And then I was like, oh, wait, Amy, you should look up what the conversion rate is for this, because feeling it's real bad. And although the embezzlement wasn't a good look, Cronin also caught some flack for airing the organization's dirty laundry in public, which, as you can imagine, is a big no-no in a secret society.
Mm-hmm.
Although allegedly very few members believe this allegation against Sullivan, an internal trial was established in New York to investigate Cronin's claim, and a six-man committee, including Dr. Cronin, investigated the triangle. After 5 months of heated debate, the committee eventually voted 4-2 that the charges had not been proven, and Sullivan was cleared of the accusations. Despite this verdict, however, they were apparently unable to account for between 100,000 and 250,000 of the organization's funds.
Girl, that's so much money.
It's so much money. Like, bro, come on.
You couldn't get a receipt or anything, you know?
Like, it's not, you know, you didn't steal like a couple $100. Like, you're stealing the equivalent of $3.3 million at least, at minimum. Like, come on. Unsurprisingly, Cronin refused to acknowledge the decision, continued to accuse Sullivan of corruption, and threatened to make his notes of the proceedings public. However, after the trial, most of the Clan na Gael members considered the matter settled and returned to their homes, with the exception of one. Henry Le Caron, who I mentioned earlier and who had argued for Cronin's expulsion during his trial for quote-unquote treason, did not return to Chicago. Instead, he boarded a ship to London, where another trial was taking place. In 1887, Charles Stuart Parnell, the leading constitutional nationalist in Ireland and the leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party, was accused of being involved in the Phoenix Park murders carried out in Dublin in 1882, and of being closely tied to the Fenians as well as Clan na Gael in a series of controversial articles published by the Times of London. Although Parnell denied the charges, a parliamentary commission was established to investigate the newspaper's claims. Interest in the trial was huge at the time and drew crowds of fascinated onlookers, including the novelist Oscar Wilde, as well as Henry James, author of The Turn of the Screw,
yeah,
which you mentioned in one of your previous stories.
Yeah, the Hinton Ampner.
I literally wasn't even going to try to say it, Monique. We talked about this. I don't know how you made it through that story.
Barely made it through it right now. Those letters should not be next to each other.
Yes, correct.
Motherfuck.
On February 5th, 1889, Le Caron took the stand to give evidence against Parnell and made a shocking announcement. He was not a Frenchman dedicated to the cause of Irish freedom, as he had claimed, but was actually an Englishman named Thomas Beach. And for the last 25 years, he had been a spy for the British government.
What the fuck?
Yep. Prior to becoming a spy, he had fought alongside many Irishmen in the Union Army, including General John O'Neill, and as a result of this friendship, had joined the Fenians, claiming that his mother was Irish. He became a spy in the late 1860s, and for the next 25 years worked closely with Robert Anderson, one of Scotland Yard's first spymasters. Not only had Le Caron's intel been used in several of the articles in the Times, but it had actually been partly responsible for the capture of many of the men who'd been involved in the bombings during the Dynamite War. So that's why they all failed, is because they fucking told him what was going down. And then he was like, all right, just going to send a telegram real quick.
Yo.
Yep.
Shut the fuck up. No. Okay. Here's the thing. Obviously, I don't want anyone blowing anything up. Like, that's not cute. But also just like, it is that old adage. It's like three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. Shut the fuck up. Like, don't tell people shit.
Yes.
I've even learned it as I've become a mature woman, that even when you're doing something like starting a business or like doing, like, don't fucking tell anybody, because even people who are well-meaning have fucking opinions and can talk you out of shit.
Yep.
Move in silence. That's how you get shit done.
Yes.
But also don't blow shit up. I'm not condoning that. But, you know, hot take.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of siding with Le Caron on this one. Like, the spy thing isn't great, but I'm sure he saved some lives.
Oh, 10,000%. Yeah, 10,000%. It's the thing that, as we learn more and more every week, criminals are just really bad at it.
Yeah.
And they can't shut the fuck up about their crimes for some reason.
Correct. The news that they'd had a traitor in their ranks shocked the members of Clan na Gael, who, despite the absolute failure of the Dynamite War, surprisingly never seemed to suspect the presence of a spy. Yes, Sullivan accused Cronin of being a spy, but that was really just slander. He didn't actually believe that, from what I can tell.
Right, just shit-talking.
Apparently, with the exception of Dr. Cronin, no one ever suspected that Le Caron was a spy. He'd been close to many senior Klansmen and had always been openly passionate about the cause of Irish liberation. Le Caron denied that he was either an informer or a traitor, and instead said he saw himself as a military spy, serving among the enemies of his country for the good of the public. Unsurprisingly, Le Caron's testimony in Parnell's trial and the revelation that he was in fact a British spy caused some drama in Clan na Gael back in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Cronin and his supporters were quick to point out that Le Caron had been very close to Sullivan in an attempt to discredit him, while Sullivan, on the other hand, claimed that Le Caron had named four other Clan na Gael members who were British spies. And of course, Cronin's name had been on the list. Although there is no evidence to suggest such a list ever existed, rumors began to circulate, and many members were quick to believe that Le Caron was not the only spy in their organization. As one member argued, quote, "The English government would not have taken Le Caron from America if there were not people to take his place here," end quote. By the spring of 1889, the whispers about Cronin in certain circles became firm statements of quote-unquote fact. Although the allegation was very likely untrue, it was a disaster for Cronin, since those suspected of spying in Irish Republican circles usually didn't survive for very long.
Mm-hmm.
Cronin knew his life was in danger and told his friends as much. He became increasingly paranoid to the point that he started carrying a Smith & Wesson with him. Then, in spring of 1889, a man named Patrick O'Sullivan visited Cronin at his practice to make him an offer, which, so there's no confusion, it's O'Sullivan, so obviously no relation to Alexander Sullivan. There's a lot of Sullivans happening now, though.
Girl, that's what happens when you deal with the Irish.
I know. Patrick was the owner of an ice house in Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood, which was very dangerous work at the time, and he offered Dr. Cronin an $8 or $264 with inflation monthly stipend to act as his company's on-call physician and respond whenever one of O'Sullivan's employees needed medical attention. Now, this was a little strange because O'Sullivan's ice house only had four employees and had never had an employee injury. And despite there being many doctors located much closer to Lakeview, he came all the way to Cronin's practice, who didn't live anywhere near the ice house.
This is like on-call hitman shit.
Yep. But despite Cronin's paranoia at the time, he apparently didn't think this was at all suspicious and accepted the offer. Then around 8 o'clock on May 4th, 1889, while Dr. Cronin was visiting with friends in his apartment, a man rang the doorbell. He showed Cronin Patrick O'Sullivan's card and said one of the employees had been badly injured and they needed a doctor immediately. Dr. Cronin grabbed his bag and immediately left in a carriage pulled by a white horse. But he never returned home. The following morning, his friends Theo and Cordelia Conklin, who had been visiting with Cronin when he was called away, realized the doctor hadn't returned. They immediately became concerned because, one, it was unlike him not to return home, and two, Cronin had previously told them his life was in danger. So the two reported him missing to the police that day. Detective Daniel Coughlin was assigned to the case, and in case you don't remember, Coughlin had not only been on the panel of five men to try Cronin for his supposed treason and voted to expel him, but was also one of Sullivan's supporters. So, huge conflict of interest there, but apparently nobody gives a shit. So, it should come as no surprise that he seemed unconcerned about Cronin's disappearance and basically just said that Cronin was a grown, unmarried man, so if he didn't come home on a Saturday night, then that was his business. But Dr. Cronin's friends suspected that he had been murdered, so Theo Conklin decided to do some investigating on his own and drove to Lakeview to ask O'Sullivan about the house call. O'Sullivan had no idea what he was referring to, because all of his employees were in good health and no one from the ice house had called for the doctor. Coughlin claimed that he and his fellow officers had searched high and low, but had found no trace of Cronin or a crime. However, around 2 a.m. on May 5th, the night after Cronin disappeared, two Lakeview police officers reported that they witnessed a carpenter's wagon carrying a large trunk speeding north on Clark Street. At 3:30 a.m., the wagon returned, this time without the trunk. The officers stopped the wagon, but finding nothing suspicious, let the two men driving it continue on their way. The following morning, however, a large trunk was seen in a ditch on Evanston Avenue, and the Lakeview police were called. When they opened the trunk, they found blood spatter and blood-soaked cotton inside, as well as a dark brown lock of hair. After examining the trunk, Lakeview Police Captain Villers concluded that an adult had been murdered and stuffed inside, and by his estimation, the murder likely took place around midnight. The police searched the brush, grass, and vacant houses for a mile surrounding where the trunk was found, but there was no trace of a body. Although they thought it was possible that the hair found in the trunk belonged to Dr. Cronin, he was reportedly seen on a streetcar by a friend at 9 p.m. on May 4th, and the sighting was verified by the streetcar conductor. The newspaper offices in Chicago were immediately notified of Cronin's disappearance on May 5th, and quote-unquote sleuth reporters were already launching their own investigations by the end of the day. Journalists used combination reporting, collaborating, and sharing information to produce more detailed reports on the Cronin case, and began specifically scrutinizing the police. Many believed that the discovery of the bloody trunk was proof that Dr. Cronin had been murdered, but other rumors still emerged. On May 10th, Charles T. Long, the son of a prominent newspaper publisher in Toronto, who belonged to a secret society with Cronin, sent dispatches to Chicago's morning papers saying that Cronin, who, although he described as slightly deranged, was in fact, right?
That's an incredible description.
Right?
That's incredible.
Literally, like, in quotes, so you know it was in the fucking letter.
That's like, incredible. I would like the record to show that he was slightly deranged.
Slightly deranged.
That's incredible.
It's, like, rude, first of all.
But also, how is it slightly? Like, you're either, right? Like, whole hog or nothing. You know what I mean?
Aren't we all a little slightly deranged? Come on.
Girl, who among us? Literally.
Come on. So, he's slightly deranged, but, in fact, alive and well in Canada. The press suggested that Cronin was possibly fleeing persecution for performing an illegal abortion or was avoiding the consequences of a romantic affair. There were even rumors that Cronin had admitted to being a British spy and had gone back to England. Although the newspapers in Ireland paid much less attention to Cronin's murder, reporting that it was the actions of individuals and not a larger conspiracy, American journalists treated the case as a sensational murder mystery and sometimes embellished reports to attract higher readership.
In Chicago, of all fucking places, it's like murder capital. Like, they love this shit.
Yes.
Again, there's a fucking musical about it.
And it's just called Chicago.
Yeah. No, like, there's not guys, even hiding.
Yeah.
We all fucking know, right?
We know where, like, this is going down.
We know.
Yeah. Then on May 22nd, the Public Works Department in Lakeview was called to investigate a jammed sewer near Broadway and Foster Avenue. When they discovered the blockage, they first thought it was the body of a dog. But when they removed it, they realized it was actually a man.
Oof.
Yep. Although there was considerable deterioration, they automatically assumed it was Cronin. The body was completely naked, except for a bloody towel wrapped around his neck. Under the towel, he was wearing an Agnus Dei, a Catholic medal depicting the Lamb of God. So they suspected that Catholics must have killed him, as they would have been too afraid to remove a sign of God from the body.
I'm sorry.
This was in the podcast.
So Catholics, murder, on the up and up, removing an Agnus Dei, that's a bridge too far.
I guess so.
And here's the thing. The rationalizations of people are insane. And Catholics throughout history have definitely had their fair fun of murder. I don't know where this story is going. If that's the case, that's fucking insane. I just wanted to throw my Catholic sense in there.
I did want your opinion on this because I didn't know if this was an actual thing. To me, it seemed a little like, if you're going to murder a guy, like, I think you're already pissing God off. Like, you can take the cross off of him. It's fine.
I would imagine. I've never heard of that personally.
I never have, but it weirdly kind of makes sense to me. Like, sure, the murder is a no-no. You're kind of already fucking up with God. But, like, I feel like if you were a Baptist or an atheist or something, you would have no problem taking that off the body. And I feel like the only people who would, like, possibly leave it on were people who were super religious
or didn't notice or didn't care.
Yeah, I don't know.
And here's the thing. Obviously, this is the 1890s, so I don't know culturally what the fuck was going on there. It seems like people probably wouldn't give a shit. The only reason I would find it interesting that it was stayed on is if it was of value, like if it was like a gold medallion or something, and they left it instead of pawning it.
That was kind of my thought, too.
That was the implication? Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. No, they didn't say what it was made of or anything. I have no idea. But like I thought that too. Yeah, I was like, I mean, everything is worth something in this time. So
for sure.
Even if it's whatever, like a
like boots or some shit. Yeah,
yeah, and like carved. Like he's naked completely. There's nothing else on him, and this is the only thing, and it happens to be a religious thing. Like,
yeah,
I can kind of see it. But again, I'm not the religious one. So
you're a dirty heathen.
Yeah, I am totally. A filthy heathen. Proudly, thank you.
I also have never murdered anyone, so I don't. Sure. Okay. Like, I it doesn't make sense to me, but okay. Sure. Great.
Okay. I was like,
so, moving anyway, on. I was just very on. Confused yes. by this rationalization, but okay. Sure.
This was just something they mentioned in the podcast that I like thought was interesting and wanted your opinion on, because it's not something I really would have thought, because I'm like, no. You just killed a guy. Thou shalt not murder. Like, I'm pretty sure he's pissed at you. You can remove the necklace if you want. I don't think he's going to be like, that was a bridge too far.
I also understand like the Italian mob, they like claim to be Christian and Catholic and, you know, but they murder, their whole gig is murdering people. But they'll do shit sometimes. They'll be like, well, I won't shoot you in the face so you can have like an open casket at your funeral. Like a big fuck you with the Italian mob is they shoot you in the face so that you can't, so that your mother can't view your body.
Oh.
Yeah. That's how you know you like really fucked up, is they fuck up your face.
Damn.
Yeah, that's savagery. Mm-hmm.
That is kind of savage. I've never really considered that.
Yeah, like we've talked about it, I don't think on the podcast, but privately about like anything that would prevent, like my means of death that would prevent me from having an open casket is very upsetting to me.
Yes.
Just because culturally that's just what you do. So if it was like she was so fucked up, you can't even gawk at her fucking corpse, like that would be really upsetting to me.
I'm the complete opposite, because
you're like, don't look at me. I'm
that too, but
I'm
also
dead.
I wouldn't want
you don't
want
to look you.
I don't want to look you. Also, I would want to be cremated, so I wouldn't. There sure. wouldn't be any viewing of my body. I don't want anyone to look at my dead body. Thanks, unless you yeah. need to for legal reasons and like for identification. Like otherwise, yeah. I don't want that to be in anyone's memory. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, it is a bit of a closure thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's also like you've never really like. Luckily, not really dealt with that. And I dealt with it a lot. So,
yeah. I don't know. I'm very inexperienced in this world. So I'm
Thank
not the
fuck.
Expert.
It's not yeah. the best.
No.
Would not recommend.
No.
Just
I don't want it. Like, please.
Not my favorite.
I'm not asking for it. I'm not, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay with living this life.
But I guess like, you know, like people who claim to be religious make all sorts of weird justifications for bad behavior. So.
Yeah,
sure. Maybe this is I don't know. I'm still of that weirdo thing, you know, like thou shalt not kill. But fuck me, what do I know, right?
But God's like, it's all right. Just don't touch my necklace, please.
Just don't,
thanks.
Please.
He looks really.
You know,
cute.
I got that at a Claire's.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, and it was a 2-for-1, so it was like really special.
I was like, I actually have the other half. It's our BFF necklace, so if you wouldn't mind, thanks.
I have the other half of the lamb.
Yeah.
Which is great because we're recording this right before Easter. So I just love a really blasphemous moment.
I totally forgot it was Easter coming up.
Oh yeah, because God, you're the heathen and I'm not.
I'm like, the only it. Holiday that matters this month is the drinking one. Thank you.
St. Patrick's Day. Of
course. Let's do this.
Of course.
So the body was positively identified by friends of Cronin's, and his dentist identified gold fillings that he had recently placed for Dr. Cronin. During the autopsy, the coroner found 5 scalp wounds made by a sharp, narrow weapon. Although it was originally believed to be an ice pick, which obviously made for sensational headlines. Yeah.
And scalp wounds, you said?
Yeah. So they're like, ice picked him in the brain. I know. Except Gillian O'Brien, who wrote the book on the case I mentioned earlier, believes it was more likely a chisel, which, again, it's an
Doesn't
ice house. So
matter.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
Both are awful. I'm brutal. No, thank you.
You have to go through like bone. Like you're, ugh.
Yep. Ooh, I know.
I don't like that. Mm.
Cronin's neck was also broken, and he had been struck with a blunt instrument on his cheek and temple. Cronin's clothes, which had been cut from his body, were eventually found in November in a manhole at Broadway and Buena Avenue. After the body was discovered, police finally started taking the investigation seriously. They began by interviewing the neighbors who lived near O'Sullivan's ice house, who told police about a strange man who had rented a cottage nearby, but had never moved in. Even though the cottage was unoccupied, they said that sometimes lights burned inside late at night. When police went to investigate the cottage, they knew immediately that it was the scene of the murder. There was a considerable amount of blood on the front steps and in several of the rooms, and the floor had been recently painted yellow in a clumsy attempt to hide the blood.
Girl.
Which, like, I can't even imagine walking in and being like, what? Why did you think that you were suddenly covering up all of the blood by just, like, slapping a coat of paint on it?
What's up with the marigold floors, bro?
Oh my God, no.
God.
They found the key to the trunk in the cottage, and the mark on the furniture showed that it had all come from a store named Revels. When they visited the furniture store, they discovered that the furniture, including a trunk matching the description of the bloodstained one they'd found, bro, had been rented by a man calling himself J.B. Simmons.
Wait, you rent a trunk? You're renting a trunk to move a dead body in? Yeah. A bloody one, not even like just dead, like, yeah, bro.
I mean, he's not going to get his deposit back, obviously, but...
I mean, no.
Yeah. No, when I read that too, I was like, what? That's fucked up. Like, buy it at least outright. Come on.
I mean, so you're cheap and you're a murderer.
Yes.
It's not a cute look.
J.B. Simmons, who, based on the description they were given, police suspected was actually a man named Pat Cooney, also known as the Fox, who was a friend of Patrick O'Sullivan and Detective Coughlin and a bitter enemy of Cronin's. However, Cooney fled Chicago and was apparently just never found. Although, they may have found his finger because in the cotton batting found with Cronin's body, investigators found a man's severed finger. And since neither Cronin or any of the eventual suspects were missing a finger, they believed that it was Cooney's.
Like that he like hacked it off by accident mid-murder?
I have no idea. I have no idea. There was no like further information about this detail, but I was like, I'm sorry. There's just like a random severed finger showing up in this story. I can't not mention this. But again, he was never found, so they couldn't like check
like,
it out.
Bro, like, are you missing a finger?
We got it back at the station if you want it. Cool.
It's in a Ziploc. It's airtight. We got it. It's fine.
We threw it on some ice, but it's been a bunch of years, so you're probably not going to want it back.
Little gangrenous. You know, whatever. Oh!
I know. Detectives then asked the owners of the cottage who had rented it, and they told them that it had been a man named Frank Williams, believing this was also an alias and suspecting that Williams was actually a man named Martin Burke, who was known to associate with Cooney. The police showed a picture of Burke to the owners, who confirmed that that was the man they knew as Williams. And they told police that the day they rented the cottage to Williams, they had seen him walk over to O'Sullivan and say, "Well, the cottage is rented." Police then started trying to track down the carriage and distinctive white horse that had picked up Cronin the night of his disappearance. The investigation led them to a livery stable owned by Patrick Dinnan that was located very close to the East Chicago Avenue police station. The stable was regularly used by police officers and detectives, and Dinnan told police that he had rented a horse and buggy that matched the newspaper descriptions of the ones that had taken Cronin on the night he was killed to none other than Detective Coughlin. Shocker for no one.
Yeah.
Dinnan originally confronted Coughlin about this, who apparently responded by telling him to keep quiet about it, but Dinnan didn't and reported it to Captain Shack. However, when Shack questioned Coughlin about the accusation, he accepted Coughlin's story that he had rented it to a man named Smith who was out of town and that it wasn't the same white horse.
Okay.
Yeah. There's some corruption in the police department, in case you can't.
There's some fuckery afoot.
Yes. There is some fuckery afoot.
I mean.
I love you. So when Shaq basically did nothing, Dinnan eventually told the chief of police, George W. Hubbard, And on May 25th, the Chicago Times reported that Daniel Coughlin had hired the horse and buggy used to abduct Cronin. Coughlin was interrogated by a panel that included Police Chief Hubbard and Chicago Mayor DeWitt Clinton Krieger. After giving evasive and vague answers, Coughlin was arrested as an accomplice to the abduction and murder of Cronin. On the morning of May 27th, 2 days later, Patrick O'Sullivan was called to the Lakeview Police Station and was arrested upon his arrival. After much questioning, O'Sullivan confessed that he had known Coughlin for years, was a member of Clan Nagel, had talked with quote-unquote Frank Williams, a.k.a. Martin Burke, who had rented the cottage where Cronin was murdered, and had participated in the ruse to hire Cronin as his company's physician. Shortly after, another friend of Coughlin's, John Coons, was found to be the one who drove the carriage, and he was also placed under arrest. In June, Frank Woodruff and John Beggs, two other members of Clan Nagel Camp 20 and associates of Coughlin, were also arrested for their involvement in Cronin's murder. Not long after, while trying to locate Martin Burke, police found him traveling under an alias in Winnipeg. He was captured, and after a long and bitter extradition hearing, he was returned under heavy guard to Chicago. At the recommendation of the coroner's jury, Chicago police also arrested Alexander Sullivan on June 11th. It's worth noting that this was not the first time Sullivan was arrested for suspicion of murder. In 1876, Frank Hanford, the principal of the school where Sullivan's wife was teaching, accused her of creating dissension on the school board. Sullivan paid the man a visit, and after an argument, Sullivan shot and killed Hanford.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Disproportionate response.
Correct. Correct, Monique. But Sullivan claimed it was self-defense, and after two trials, was acquitted of Hanford's murder. After his arrest for the Cronin murder, Sullivan was released on $20,000 bail. But unfortunately, due to lack of any evidence, the charges against him were eventually dropped.
Damn.
Yep. But there were several reports that people heard him talking about how Cronin needed to be, quote unquote, taken care of.
And, it's like removed. The tale as old as time. Yep. That train is never fucking late. People don't know how to shut the fuck up.
Correct.
At all. I was literally talking about this yesterday at my bar about how statistically, kind of in all crimes, even things like infidelity, men get caught way more than women do because men don't know how to shut the fuck up and women do. And even when, like, if there's a murder, it's a much higher probability that there's going to be like a jailhouse informant because a guy cannot shut the fuck up. Whereas a woman will be like, I'm not saying shit.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. I mean, also like, don't, like, we want you to get caught, but because you suck, but they like need, well, this, like, it, I don't know. I don't know they, why like, they can't shut the
validation.
Fuck up.
They need the validation. They need to,
like, they need the validation.
Like a, it's a weird brag, always.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't understand it.
And it's one thing if you're in prison and you're talking about it because you can attribute that to kind of wanting to build a reputation so you don't get fucked with in prison. Mm-hmm. So, like, I can kind of see that. But, dude, if you got away with it for now, quote unquote,
shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up. Don't mention it to anybody. Actively fucking tell them you were somewhere else doing something else. You have a fucking alibi. Shut your goddamn mouth.
Play that fucking OJ game, girl. Be like, I can't go to LA because the murderer might find me. Spoiler, it's you. But you know what? Yeah. It's a thing Wanda Sykes said. You gotta believe your lie.
Yes.
Gotta believe your lie. That has to be the truth for you. Believe your fucking lie.
Yes.
But also don't, because fuck you. We want you to get caught.
You know, I was like, just, also that. Yeah. I don't want murderers just running amok. Thank you.
Yeah. Just still be bad at your job and get caught. Fuck you.
Well, they will be, generally.
Yes, exactly.
Although there were no real confessions and no one ever said who killed Dr. Cronin, on June 29th, O'Sullivan, Coughlin, Coons, Burke, Woodruff, and Beggs were all indicted for the murder of Dr. Cronin. Jury selection began on August 26, 1889, and continued through October 22nd.
Damn.
Yes. Since the press coverage of the Cronin case had been basically nonstop since his disappearance, it was very difficult to find jurors who had not already formed an opinion on the case.
Sure.
In total, 1,115 men were interviewed for jury selection.
Damn.
And at the time, this was the largest and longest jury selection process in American history.
Sure.
The trial finally began on October 23rd, 1889, and it was reported that over 5,000 people showed up at the courthouse that day.
Holy shit.
Just to fucking try to get one of the 200 seats in the courthouse and hang around outside.
Girl, I mean, what else did they have going on?
Also true.
Yeah.
Over the next 3.5 months, the defense and prosecution culled 190 witnesses. Holy
damn.
Fuck. This trial so was no many joke. Witnesses. It's so many witnesses. Holy I would not fuck. Want to cross-examine all of them.
No.
The defense tried to discredit Cronin by accusing him of being either a violent radical or a British spy, which I guess they thought made the murder justified somehow. I don't really get this argument, but okay. The prosecution argued that the renting of the White Horse was the strongest evidence against Coughlin. The identification by the owners of the cottage was the evidence that convicted Burke, and the contract with the doctor and the incident with the business card implicated O'Sullivan. Letters and testimony of fellow Klansmen implicated Beggs in the appointment of a secret committee to, quote-unquote, take care of Dr. Cronin. After a 3.5-month-long trial and deliberating for a full 3 days, the jury finally reached their verdicts on December 16th. Daniel Coughlin, Patrick O'Sullivan, and Martin Burke were all found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life imprisonment. John Coons, the driver of the carriage, was found guilty of manslaughter and sentenced to 3 years, but eventually appealed and was granted a new trial, which did result in his acquittal. John Beggs was found not guilty, and since there was not enough evidence against Frank Woodruff, his case was dropped. At the time, it was the longest-running trial in American history, and damn. The murder of Dr. Cronin was called, at the time, the crime of the century. Mm-hmm. But, I know, another crime of the century.
So many.
But, as Edmund Pearson points out, quote, anyone with the faintest knowledge of Chicago will remember that the city has a crime of the century every 4 or 5 years, end quote.
Oh, I was going to say, like, every 2 fucking yeah. weeks.
Which I loved, because I was like, when I read that, I was like, wait, I feel like Monique did a story from this time, and it was also the crime of the century. Like, what?
Yeah.
And then yes. I saw that, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure, I think it's like Henry Bendel. I'm not remembering. Nope, that's a makeup and jewelry place. But the one that I mentioned earlier is around this time period as well. And the murders that inspired the movie Chicago are around this. Like, there's so many crimes of the century.
Yes. Murder is just the crime of the century, and everyone's into it, apparently.
Yeah. For sure.
After the trial, Sullivan's supporters claimed that since Beggs, the leader of Camp 20, and therefore of the alleged conspiracy, had been found innocent, that this was proof that there was no conspiracy, and that Cronin had just been murdered by individuals acting on their own behalf. But the general public was convinced that Cronin was an innocent man, murdered because he exposed corruption within Clan na Gael. Correct, general public. You fucking know.
Yes.
In late January 1890, Daniel Coughlin, Patrick O'Sullivan, and Martin Burke were sent to Joliet Prison to serve their sentences. From prison, Daniel Coughlin campaigned for a retrial, and in 1893, the Illinois Supreme Court agreed. Both Burke and O'Sullivan had died in prison of tuberculosis the previous year, though, so Coughlin was the only man to attend the retrial, where he was cleared of all charges and released.
There you go. I was waiting for it, but here it is.
However, most believe that the jury was bribed.
Yes, it is Chicago. Sorry, not to shit on Chicago. I love Chicago, but historically,
it's a thing that happens. Yeah,
it was a thing.
After he was released, Daniel Coughlin opened a saloon in Chicago, but was eventually charged with attempting to bribe jurors. Yep. In damaged suit cases when he was an employee of the Illinois Railway Company. Hence why it's likely he bribed the jury in his retrial.
Mm-hmm.
When the indictments were brought against him, though, Coughlin fled to Honduras, where he eventually died in 1911. Cronin's funeral was the most attended in Chicago since Abraham Lincoln's.
Damn!
Although the body was too decomposed and damaged for an open casket, on Saturday, May 25th, 1889, nearly 12,000 people visited Calvary Armory to see Cronin's coffin. 8,000 men marched in his funeral procession, and 5,000 people gathered at the cemetery for the entombment.
That's so many fucking people.
So many people. Like, this is a murder that just, like, gripped the city at this time. Like,
clearly,
the news was running it nonstop. It was, like, all anyone could talk about, basically.
Holy fuck.
Because it's, like, murder, secret societies, police corruption, fucking everything all together.
Yeah.
Despite the attendance and support at his funeral, few in Chicago were prepared openly to defend the cause of Irish republicanism after Cronin's murder. And Clan na Gael had now become synonymous with corruption and murder. Many had only joined the society as a way of securing a good job, not because they really had any interest in Irish nationalism.
Sure. I mean, that's the fucking tea. I know Leslie Jones used to work for Scientology. And
oh,
she was like a she was like a telemarketer for Scientology.
Oh my God.
And she was like, girl, I need to get paid, and that check cleared. And I was like, I mean,
do what you gotta do.
Do what you gotta do. Yeah. You gotta pay your shit.
Just don't drink the flavor aid and you're good.
That's right.
Yeah. But Cronin's murder forced them to make a political decision, and many of them chose to walk away from involvement in any form of Irish nationalism afterwards. The Catholic Church officially denounced Clan na Gael, and the public began openly protesting secret societies, with thousands of Chicagoans attending protest meetings to push for the suppression of secret societies. There was also a significant decrease in Irish pride in general afterwards. St. Patrick's Day, which had previously been widely celebrated by the Irish community with parades and parties, was actually canceled the year after Cronin's murder.
Damn.
Since there was just no public appetite for the celebration of anything Irish. Although the St. Patrick's Day parade returned the following year in 1891, it was a subdued affair, and it was many years before St. Patrick's Day was celebrated with the same level of enthusiasm that we see today. According to Henry M. Hunt, the murder of Cronin ranked in national importance with the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln and James A. Garfield, as the gruesome crime was an international sensation, and Cronin was celebrated as an Irish-American hero and a martyr. Newspapers continued to run stories about Cronin's murder until the 1950s. In 1929, for the 40th anniversary of Cronin's death, the Chicago Tribune ran a contest in which readers were asked to, quote-unquote, solve the mystery of the case for a $500 prize.
I'm sorry, do we not know how that?
Well, I mean, it never really came out who...
Legally? I understand legally.
Yeah. It never really came out who actually physically killed him.
Uh-huh.
All of these people were involved in the plot.
Right.
But it was never confirmed who was the actual
the quote-unquote murderer. Trigger man, even though it was a stab man.
Yes. It seems like Alexander Sullivan was the one who kind of orchestrated everything, put everything into motion.
Mm-hmm.
However, he was basically the only one who got off completely.
Yeah, right.
He was smart enough, clearly, to outsource all of the work and be like, I can't get involved, but like, do this shit.
Yeah. And especially since forensics was like not a fucking thing back in the day.
No.
So did anyone win the $500?
They did not say that. I have a feeling that no one got the $500.
Because it would just be speculation, obviously. Yes. There's no fucking concrete evidence.
Yes, correct. And that is the story of Clan na Gael and the murder of Dr. Patrick Henry Cronin.
That was fucking wild.
It was fucking wild. And I was deeply intrigued by this. I'm like weirdly fascinated by secret societies. And
yeah,
I just thought this was very interesting. I have one more fun fact for you that didn't really
love a fun fact
fit into the story. So the people who owned the cottage that he was murdered in were really worried that they'd never be able to rent it again.
Sure.
Cronin's murder was so popular that they literally opened it as a tourist attraction.
Yep.
Thousands of people came to see, and you could literally take souvenirs home, which included pieces of bloody wood from like the furniture and the fucking floor.
Yep. So when you see these articles, especially in the last 10 years, it's like, why true crime now? As if this bullshit hasn't been happening for literally for fucking ever. Literally for fucking ever. I remember reading that outside of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping trial, people were selling locks of blonde baby hair, quote unquote, that allegedly belonged to the fucking baby, because this is who we've been since fucking forever.
Oh my God. That's so horrifying.
It is.
Humans are morbid creatures. We really are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, people love that shit. People love that shit. I'm sure they made way more fucking money than if there was no murder bank that ever happened.
Yeah.
But you know what? Good on you. Enterprising. Yay, capitalism.
Right?
You know?
I know. Part of me was like, I weirdly respect the hustle here.
Absolutely. Way to turn an unfortunate situation around.
Make that murder money. Like, whatever you gotta do. I got it.
My God. I fucking love you.
I love you. And I loved your story. I will never give it over there being portals. So
no.
My brain is ruined forever. But I am into it. I like it.
I loved your story. I knew 0% of it. And it's always very fascinating when something grips a society and a nation and has like long reaching effects, like how like for an extended period of time, like celebrating anything Irish was just like not okay.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is kind of bullshit because of these fuckheads, these, you know, group of fuckheads.
Which considering like Chicago literally dyes the river green.
Green. Like they fucking go
they
hard.
They go hard. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
To imagine just yeah, like having nothing and literally we're like.
St. Paddy's Day's canceled.
Yeah.
That's fucking wild.
Insane.
But I love that. It was so deeply fascinating.
I thought so. I thought you'd be into that.
And I, girl, you know, I love a theme and you nail it every time.
Thank you. I do love a theme.
And we love you guys. This is another fucking horror podcast. I'm Monique Sanchez.
And I'm Amy Traden.
You can find me on the gram at pinupgirlmo.
You can find me at lobotomy, and that's Labot period Amy.
Follow the show on the gram. We have some cool shit coming out in the next few weeks. So you're going to want to be following it to be abreast of all the cool shit. We're at another fucking horror podcast. Next week, we are doing a True Listener Tales episode where we read you your true crazy stories. So if you have one or you just want to say hi, email us at anotherfuckinghorrorpodcast@gmail.com with a period instead of the you and fucking. If you guys are enjoying the show, please tell your friends, but especially more than that, please rate, review, and subscribe, especially reviewing, because the more reviews and ratings we get, the more visibility we get, which means that hopefully sooner rather than later, we can do this full time and bring you more murdery, ghosty stories that you've come to know and love. Guys, we're so fucking obsessed with you. As always, keep it cute.
Keep it creepy.
Bye.